Batman and the Demon. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Batman and the Demon, from Brave and the Bold number 109, cover dated November 1973. And Chris, I think people tend to forget that Jason Blood also lives in Gotham City.
I think a lot of writers tend to forget that. Plus, Alan Scott and the JSA were headquartered in Gotham. Gotham was a pretty busy city, you know, in the DC universe at different points throughout its history.
It fits. I guess it fits, you know, the demons and that there's something dark about Gotham City. But you'd think that Batman and the Demon would meet up more often.
Right.
This is their first team up. So, you know, very early in the Demon's career, as we'll see, as we preface with reasons why we like the guest character. What's so great about the Demon for you?
Well, I mean, I like the fact I learned about this probably by 10, 15 years ago, but I just love this, that Jack Kirby based his design on a strip he remembered from Hal Foster's Prince Valiant. And in that story, Prince Valiant wore the skin of a goose to look like a demon. That's why Etrigan has those funny little ears. They were goose wings. So right. I just think that's great. I mean, it's kind of grotesque to think he stretched the skin of a goose over his face and just kind of blah. But I first encountered Etrigan the Demon in a reprint of his first issue in DC Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 5. So for our beloved Digest cast, there you go. It's November, December 1980 was the cover date. And I must admit, my 5-year-old brain couldn't track the Jack Kirby art at all. I thought everybody looked demonic or weird or, you know.
It's just... Well, it sort of did, right? It was part of the appeal, I think, of that strip.
It was a Secret Origins Digest. So...
Right, so you had all the Camelot stuff.
Yep, I had all the Camelot stuff. Yeah, it was straight up. It always stuck out to me, you know, this, it made an impression, you know, by reading the first issue of the series at a very young age, or probably at that point, I don't even know if I could quite read yet. My mom probably read it to me. I was getting there, but I probably wasn't quite there yet. It made quite an impression. So I had this, oh, that's that guy from the Digest. And then he showed up in the Wonder Woman comic when I was reading it for the Huntress, but he showed up in the Wonder Woman comic. So I've heard that Jack Kirby didn't care for the character really, because he'd rather kept doing his Fourth World series. But the idea of a demonologist turning into a demon to more or less fight evil, that's just a great concept. I think there's a lot of potential for Etrigan. Honestly, I think nowadays with the technology and the special effects we have, it would make a great live action TV series. I mean, even divorced from the DC universe, it could be a really cool series. And, you know, just like Commandy last time, this is Etrigan's first appearance outside of the demon title in a story that's not written and drawn by Jack Kirby. So this is really kind of a special. This is where the Etrigan enters the DC universe, even if it's Bob Haney's Earth B corner of it. So
yeah, we'll talk about some of the discrepancies that crop up on Earth B for Bob. I mean, he's got such a great look. You know, Jim Aparo can't not do it justice as well. You know, he looks good even when he's off-brand.
I will say, though, if you have red hair with a white streak in the DC universe, beware, because some supernatural power is going to graft some otherworldly power onto you and make you met out their brand of justice. I mean, Jim Corrigan, Jason Blood, I mean, don't, that hair color combination, you're cursed. That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, the Demon's been on the show before, in person. I mean, my first Demon story was DC Comics Presents number 66.
Mm.
So Joe Kubert also doing justice to this character. And there's an episode that covers this on the feed. So my preferred Demon is the rhyming version. So I was always shocked looking back at the Kirby stuff that there's no rhyming. You know, that was actually, some people think Alan Moore made that happen in the pages of Swamp Thing. But he invented the idea of a rhymer demon and that there's like a rhyming cast or something. But it was Len Wein in that DC Comics Presents that made him rhyme for the first time, as far as I can parse out. So to me, the rhyming demon was my favorite demon. So whenever he's not rhyming, like when Action Comics was a team-up book and John Byrne didn't make him rhyme, I was like, ugh, that just doesn't work for me. But of course, as a Jack Kirby fan, I dutifully bought the omnibus, read the original. So I have it right here because I, you know, there's some stuff Bob Haney was doing. I was like, wait a minute. Is that true to the comic? And so I have it on my table here, just like flipping through it. And I did enjoy it, you know, as a big, I don't know, Kirby doing Supernatural. He'd done it in short stories for anthology mm-hmm. books, obviously. I think overall, this is just a fun take on the Jekyll and Hyde formula, on the Hulk formula, you know, the alter ego that is evil, but reined in by the other personality or by other forces, you know, and sometimes not reined in at all.
Depending. Right.
Because the demon has already had a publication history detailed on this show, we won't go over it again. So you're off the hook, Chris.
Woo. All right.
But maybe if you have favorite demon stories or runs, this would be the time to mention them. I'll throw in the Garth Ennis, Tom McRae run mm-hmm. as probably the time I was reading the demon most dutifully. I'd missed the start of the Grant Semix run. So this was sort of my jumping on point at that time. And I've always wanted to go back and read those earlier issues, The War in Hell, all this stuff. So it intrigues me. And then I like the idea behind Demon Knights, one of the few New 52 books that I thought was clever. Paul Cornell was writing, so he's one of my favorite writers. I admit that, though Etrigan, I would say, is kind of a favorite character for me, I don't necessarily read everything he's in.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's like, oh, no, I can tell this isn't very good, or it just wasn't on during my peak periods of reading comics. A favorite character that I don't read is comics. This is sort of what happened to the demon. What about you?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I always like it when he shows up, and I'm like, oh, cool, it's Etrigan. I think you say Etrigan, and I, because it rhymes with man, I know, and I say Etrigan.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't go as hard into the and part, but it's like Rob's Han and Han thing, you know. But
the way they say it on screen is the way that it should be said.
Well, he's going by way Lando said it, see? So he's it's the cool way to say it,
and
right?
And Lando knew him from before. So that's
right.
Probably the more accurate. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm actually got a mug that's got Han and Lando on it right now that I'm drinking out of.
Oh, there you go.
But yeah, so yeah, I kind of like it more when I haven't read a whole lot of like solid runs. I remember poking into the Grant Semix run and even the John Byrne Blood of the Demon run. And I enjoyed what I read of those. But I really, you know, being the DC animated guy on the network, I really enjoyed when Bruce Timm and company used him on the new Batman Adventures and then Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. And of course, he figures into Cindy and my, one of our favorite episodes of Justice League Unlimited, which is kid stuff where you get baby Etrigan.
Right.
Which is just wonderful. And Cindy loves it so much that our daughter, Danny, crocheted her a little stuffed baby Etrigan. So there's a baby Etrigan that like sits on our bed during the day, you know, and it gets thrown off at night, but it's like, there's a baby Etrigan in our house. Kind of weird. I like when they make an action figure of him. I'm like, ooh, I need to get that, you know, cause I just think he's such a cool visual, but I need to get that omnibus and, or just go on a DC Universe Unlimited app and read the Kirby run all the way through. Cause I've dropped in and out here and there. And I actually wanted to do that before we recorded this episode, and life, you know, just didn't get to. So
it's 16 issues. It's a chunk of time.
Right, right, right. Now I've got my new Gods omnibus. I still haven't Fourth World, sorry, omnibus that I still haven't read the whole thing of. So, you know, I've got to get through that one of these days.
So, all right. I think we're ready to get to the synopsis. The story is called Gotham Bay Be My Grave. Great title.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by Bob Haney with art by Jim Aparo. Here's how it goes. As a 50-ton caisson is put in place by a bridge-building crew in Gotham City Harbor, a misshapen human form climbs up and out, slapping a workman into the water, then jumping aboard a tugboat below and brutally attacking its captain.
Greetings, citizens. This is Batman. I was on my morning patrol with Gotham Police helicopter pilot Captain Ed when I noticed a small tugboat out of control. I swang down on my bat rope to find one of the workers from the nearby bridge construction swimming out of the harbor onto the boat. He told me of what he saw, and I found the captain. dead and brutalized as if by a wild animal. After Commissioner Gordon arrived, the worker then pointed us toward where this monster had fled, to the docks at Gotham Harbor. We later found the purser from a local cruise ship, savagely killed in his office in the same manner as the captain. With the thing nowhere in sight, Commissioner Gordon ordered the entire city on emergency alert.
Cut to Jason Blood's apartment, where his romantic interest, Glenda Mark, is, as usual, asking too many questions. His friends Harry Matthews, no relation, and psychic UN delegate Randu Singh suddenly arrive with information that might interest the famed demonologist. A demonic figure has killed two sailors and is loose in the city. Harry doesn't really take the hint because he's now off to his yacht. Jason Blood next gets a visit from Merlin, the demon's master, who schedules a summoning of Etrigan on the morrow. As the astral call ends, Jason hears a scream outside. It's Harry being attacked by the creature. Leave, leave, the form of man, rise the demon, Etrigan! And so his alter ego attacks the muddy beast. But it's at least as strong as Etrigan is. The demon throws it into a carousel, but it slaps back immediately. He throws some hellfire at it, but it breathes it in like it's nothing. The creature careens into the night, and the demon gives chase.
Luckily, I was patrolling that area of Gotham when I heard a ruckus. I borrowed a net from the zoo, and I thought I had caught our murderous man-beast. Instead, it was another nightmarish figure. A demon. Two citizens approached, one chanting something, and suddenly the demon turned into a man I recognized. Noted demonologist Jason Blood. I knew of the two other men as well, famed UN delegate Randu Singh and infamous huckster Harry Matthews. They took me to Jason Blood's apartment where I learned of his fascinating double life as this demon, Etrigan. Matthews had been wearing a yachting outfit, so we had another potential victim dressed as a mariner. With no leads, Blood offered the services of Randu's ESP powers. That stands for extrasensory perception. The four of us raced to Commissioner Gordon's office, who ensured us he had the harbor under extra protection due to the pattern of the attacks.
Randu attempts his post-cognitive trick on a police sketch of the monster, and his mind goes back to the 19th century, 1883, a sailing ship somewhere west of Java. Jack Dobbs, guilty of murdering the first mate, is condemned to be hanged. But before he can walk up to the gallows, Krakatoa explodes, destroying the ship, but sending Hobbs and his iron brig into the depths. Sometime later, another ship, the Lady Claire, out of Gotham City, investigates and finds little of the previous vessel. But an undead Hobbs climbs aboard and starts killing the crew one by one. The ship still sails home, deserted, and is towed into Gotham Harbor, but Hobbs is still aboard and sinks her. An exhausted Randu comes out of his trance.
Now we knew the origins of this malevolent malcontent. Hatred for his former captain continued to drive him to live against all odds and compelled him to murder those who looked like him. When the Lady Claire sank in the harbor, Dobbs must have been encased in the mud for decades, only released by the bridge's construction. His lava-covered skin protected him from Etrigan's demonic fire. Jason ponders what kind of weakness the creature could have, but Gordon and I send him and his friends off as we continue our official police investigation. If seafaring men were the prey of this monster, then so be it. I disguise myself in nautical apparel and walk the docks singing an old sea chanty. It didn't take long for Dobbs to attack, but I was ready for him. Or so I thought. The tranquilizer needle I tried on him broke on his magma-encrusted flesh. His brute strength was far greater than my own, so all I could do was hope Gordon and his men were ready to back me up. But again, I was wrong, as they were caught up in a robbery at a firearms store. As I tried to keep the monster from making me his next victim, I pondered what Jason Blood may have been right about needing a demon to fight another.
Meanwhile, Jason Blood reads a tome on Gotham City history for clues as to the monster's weakness and heads to the Gotham Museum where, as Etrigan, he steals a coil of rope from an exhibit.
I later learned that the monster had taken my unconscious body deep into the harbor where the risen Lady Claire awaited. Luckily, Randu had tracked me with his ESP powers, and he and Etrigan arrived shortly thereafter.
Rowing to the raised ship with Randu, Etrigan finds the creature waiting for him, but before he can fight back, Merlin punishes him remotely for not showing up at the appointed hour, turning him back into Jason Blood. Randu attempts to mentally contact Merlin to inform him of his mistake, and Merlin quickly changes him back, regretting his petulant reaction. Etrigan restored, the demon snaps the creature's metal collar off, which sends it running in fear. Etrigan throws the rope, actually the noose that was once destined to execute Dobbs, over a rail, and the monster jumps right into it.
When I came to, the monster that had once been Jack Dobbs was hanging from the mast, his tortured existence finally over. Etrigan returned to his human form, and Jason explained to me that the Lady Claire's crew had pulled a rope with a noose from the wreckage of Jack Dobbs' original ship. That same noose was used to nearly hang Dobbs, so the immortal monster feared it may one day finish the job, hence the iron collar he wore. Once Etrigan retrieved that rope from the museum and removed the man-beast collar, his weakness was revealed. The three of us escaped as we watched the Lady Claire begin to return to her watery tomb, along with what remained of the monstrous Jack Dobbs.
Well, here we go. So, and the Lady Claire is still there today. I'm sure archaeologists went for it or something.
James Cameron did a movie about it, you know, a documentary probably or something.
Well, let's look at this. Let's start with the cover, as we usually do. What do you think of this one? This Jim Aparo original.
Oh, I like it, even though this scene never appears in this issue, especially with Etrigan chained up. But hey, it works in the monster, in the nautical theme. So the monster isn't wearing his collar, though. So they're kind of, you know, cheating a little bit. I did notice, though, that this monster looks a little bit like a character that Aparo would draw just a few months later, and that is the mutated version of Ra's al Ghul's servant Ubu in Detective Comics number 438, and that's like a monster stalks Wayne Manor, I think the name of that story is, but and basically it's like he got irradiated by an exploding Lazarus pit, and he's all lumpy, and he's not quite as lava mud encrusted, but he it's a similar look. It's a bald figure that's got kind of lumpy and just monstrous looking. But as far as this cover, I like how the colorist, I don't know who the colorist is, unfortunately, they stuck with the red and yellow demon colors for all the logos, Brave and the Bold, Batman, and of course Etrigan's, even the title blurb. It really pops against the blue sky and all the ocean pouring in. So
yeah, definitely. I do like the texture on the chains. If you focus in, you'll find that there's some cheating there. Just like there's chains and they're just like, you know, patching. But from a distance, from just looking at the cover normally, it does look like there's a lot more detail than there actually is on there. Like strapped to the wheel, you know, the governing thing. Did anyone at the time or even now think, oh, this is going to be Clayface, like a Clayface story, right? Because that's another character that kind of looks or could look like Hobbs here. Right.
Yeah, and Clayface was more humanoid shaped back then, the Matt Hagen.
Right.
But before the animated series made him into that big giant,
that monster.
You know, monster. Yeah.
Yeah. He's sort of in an awkward pose in a way. The way he, like, the way his foot rests on the prone Batman. I mean, it makes him look more misshapen.
Yeah, it
does. You know, he looks gooier as a result, but it's like the knee is. This is folding it.
I think that pose makes sense, but it's a pose that most comic artists probably wouldn't have done. They probably would have had the knee out pointing toward Etrigan, you know, toward that direction. But he's like in his foot, his ankle's twisted. It does make it more misshapen, but the anatomy works. It's just an odd pose you don't normally see in a comic book.
Good cover, once again. No problems there. And let's jump into page one, I guess. This is what you call story economy, right?
Right. Yeah, old school writers like Haney, they jump right in, right? You know, there's a monster coming out of this caisson. there's no buildup. There's no, you know, we don't see the construction workers like, you know, Harry the construction worker. This is what his wife packed in his lunch. This is what he's thinking about on his way to the job. And then on page five, a monster crawls out. No, on page one, a monster crawls out of the caisson.
Sure. Right? Monster attacks and superhero battles are a dime a dozen in this genre, right? It's happening all the time. So often what makes something memorable or interesting at all is the setting. And I really appreciate this here because I don't know if Haney saw an article on bridge construction or what. And there are a number of New York bridges that opened in the 1960s, which would have been an innocent experience probably. Mm-hmm. But this is a pretty unusual setting for not a superhero battle, but at least a monster attack, you know, to start our story with as a trigger for the story where the monster climbs out of the bay's floor through the caisson. You know, it's unusual, as we'll see also a superhero battle aboard a 19th century sailing ship at the end, right? All of this stuff is very unusual, and I appreciate that Bob Haney is thinking outside the box and making it interesting for himself and for us.
Yeah, that's true. Although, I will say, and I meant to mention this, that I think a few years prior, I didn't look up the dates, but the Return of Two-Face story that O'Neill and Adams did figured into an old ship that Two-Face, he like raised the ship by inflating it with stolen, basically Macy Thanksgiving Day parade balloons, and Batman's tied up to on the ship on the cover of that with a ghostly Two-Face image in the background. So DC was into like old ships from the, you know, at least from the 18th century at this point, like being raised one way or another. So
yeah, when you discover your artists can do that well.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Because when you do something unusual like this, it's also on the artist to capture it. I mean, like this, all the equipment and the crane and the tugboats and, you know, there must have been reference for this. I mean, Jim Aparo is illustrating all of this and it's not something he's necessarily used to.
Right.
You know, I think his art is great as usual in this era. You know, a lot of fog, a lot of atmospherics, in addition to his usual very dynamic superhero figures and realistic backgrounds.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for me to go back and read these early Brave and the Bolds, especially because with Batman in it, because you can see that Jim Aparo kind of later toward the mid 70s, especially the late 70s, he had kind of coalesced into his kind of standard look for everything. I mean, it was still great, but his Batman here isn't quite the Batman of the later Brave and the Bolds or Batman the Outsiders or even his later Batman run in the 80s, late 80s, because his, you know, his head's a little more round. He's just, his cowl doesn't sit on his head just quite the same, you know, his face. And
would you say he's a little more Neil Adams-ish?
I would. Yeah. I think he hasn't quite found his Batman just quite yet, because Aparo's Batman had a little bit more of a squared head between his ears than what we're seeing here. You know, I mean, not to make it like sound like he's like Frankenstein or anything, but I mean, he did have the way the cowl fit. He kind of constructed his own cowl over time, you know, the way he drew the way it fit. And he was consistent on that from a certain point here in Brave and the Bold until the very end. But this is only like what he came on the book with, like, what number was it, 98 or one, somewhere around in there. So he's only been drawing Batman like for about 10 issues at this point. So this is early in a career that, you know, was defined by him drawing Batman, basically. This is early. But I like the raw feeling of the artwork. It's just, it seems like it's more experimental. He hasn't figured out how he's going to draw everything and isn't repeating. Not that he like swiped himself like a lot, but it's almost like he had a model sheet for everything he was going to draw, and he drew it very consistently from some point on. But here it's more like, oh, I'm drawing this for the first time. How am I going to tackle this? And you just kind of get that feeling here.
His art became more and more simplified. You know, where here there's a lot more, I don't know, there's more inking work, let's say.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is more Neil Adams-ish in terms of the rendering. Even though the poses, etc., feel very Aparo. Well, you're talking about Batman. Let's talk about Batman's introduction.
I don't want to say a whole lot about that because I want to keep that for a later segment. but yeah, it's a little different than what you might expect.
I do like the scene because we've got the way he's cut up the panel. It's like it's one big panel, but he's cut it up into three. It was like one square or rectangle, cut it into three beams. It's really like the middle beam is interrupting the larger portrait, because like the third beam is just showing the caissons onto the side, which is just part of the scene. But I love how the tugboat is just spinning around. It's like going around in circles, and this is how he spots it, you know, and then the pose when he's hanging out at the helicopter and the guy coming out, the worker that got thrown to the water, who happily survived because that seemed like a pretty high fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crawling up onto the tugboat, and the water dripping behind him is just like an effect, really. I like all of this. You know, it's very dynamic action.
Yeah, it is really well done. And, this blonde character dressed in purple and green, this worker, survived a fall from a bridge by just hitting the water. So, Spider-Man, if you hadn't shot that web line, Gwen Stacy, you know, I'm just saying, she might have survived.
She might have.
Right around the same time, too. But no, I do kind of wonder, though, how did the worker says, Batman, it was awful. A horrible thing came out of the caisson. The captain, better see the captain. Well, he was busy falling into the harbor and then, presumably swimming his way back up from the depths onto the boat. How did he see the monster jump onto the boat to attack the captain?
I see it differently.
Okay.
Like, he's just climbing aboard now. The boat came within range of him. He goes for it. Okay. And maybe he was expecting help from the tugboat captain at this point. So,
okay.
Because it's two bubbles. Batman, it was awful. A horrible thing came out of the case. And that's just his experience. And then the second bubble says, the captain. Better see the captain because it's a small boat. So he doesn't see the captain. He knows this monster was around. He isn't getting help. The ship is out of control. So maybe he is just, he's worried about this guy. I don't know if he knows him personally as well. It could be because, they're working on the bridge. Yeah, I think it's just like it's a second moment. There's a beat. And
gotcha.
He's in view of the cabin. Wait, who's piloting this thing?
Yeah, why didn't the captain throw me a life preserver or something like that, right? Yeah, I get you. Okay.
Page 3. What is the celebration? The arrival of a ship or something?
Yeah, like welcome home. Well, and apparently Detective Columbo was on this ship because...
Is that how you see this character here?
Jim Aparo drew... That's Peter Falk. That's Peter Falk's Columbo. He's got the coat. I'm just waiting for him to say, ma'am, one more thing. Something. I mean, I'm just waiting for him to do that. I mean, that's... He was notorious for sneaking famous people into these Brave and the Bolds. And he's... For whatever reason... Columbo must have been trying to solve a murder mystery on a cruise ship because he's getting off this ship. So
that's funny. And there's a redheaded woman in the back, so that's probably Charlie from Poker Face. So
there you go.
And then the purser gets killed here. I'll say I love when I talk about atmospherics and all the fog that we see later, like not in this scene, but later. There's a lot of fog all the time. One of the things I love here is that the murder is shown in shadow, right?
Yeah.
They're hiding the violence up to a point. So there's a shadow, but you see like the guy's got a glass of scotch or something that's flying. Also the shadow of it, I guess. The sound, which would have been like a gruesome crack or something, is covered. Like you look at the panel and you go, what the hell? It's like he kills a guy and goes toot. But no, the sound effect, as is mentioned in the narration in the next page, it's a foghorn going off at the same time and covering the violence of the sound that should have been there. So, like, this is very, very cinematic.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of, in particular, the movie Son of Frankenstein, where Igor sends Boris Karloff's monster off to kill the people that oddly enough, that hung him, and he survived. You just see the silhouette, the shadow of the monster killing, famously one of the town elders. And it reminds me of that a lot because it's so much more, I don't know, visceral by not, and it's probably also like sidestepping the comics code too, to not show him murdering him on panel, but it's such a great effect. Yeah, the sound effect, that's a good call because there's no, you hear him go, in the word balloon, but you don't hear the snap or, and apparently he just really, they never show it, but he really mangles these.
Like the tugboat captain was torn limb from limb and we just see his legs and you're just going to, you have to imagine the mess in there. This is a more violent story than you would expect from a Comics Code approved. Even in what they show later is a little extreme. I thought it was breaking the code.
Well, and it's Jim Gordon even says, I can't look, and I've seen plenty in my time. Now, if it was Neil Hamilton from the TV series, as I was pointing to, he'd get upset seeing a jaywalker. But, you know, the grizzled Jim Gordon of the comics, even he's like, you know, I can't even look at this. This is too much for me. And he looks like he's going to get visibly ill.
For the purser, Batman. Yeah.
The purser. Yeah. Yeah, the purser, which I my only reference to for a purser really is the character of Gopher on the Love Boat is played by Fred Grandy. So this monster just killed Gopher, Fred Grandy. So
harsh.
Yeah.
God. Okay, so moving on to Jason Blood's apartment.
Well, I was going to ask you, because you said you've read some of the Demon, you've got the Omnibus. Does Jason Blood live in Park Row in the Demon series?
No. It is never mentioned one way or the other where it might be. So this is one of Bob Haney's inventions. It's not the last, I will say.
This violates Batman lore, because everyone knows that Park Row becomes Crime Alley after the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne. The upscale area of Park Row, its reputation is ruined by the murder of two of Gotham's most prominent citizens, and it just falls into decay and disarray and becomes this crime-ridden, awful part of the city that you never, ever want to walk down at night, probably not even during the day.
Even in the early 70s, or?
Maybe this is like probably, I didn't look up the date, but it might be a year before or so before Denny O'Neill wrote There Is No Hope in Crime Alley. Maybe it hasn't been established yet. I'd have to go back and look and see when Park Row was first mentioned, but I don't know if it goes back to the Batman, you know, the few times Batman's origin was touched on, you know, from the late 30s, early 40s on through the 70s. But it's established at least by the end of this decade that Park Row is, you know, was once Gotham's elite went to shop, dine, see theater, movies, etc. And now it's just the underbelly of the city because the Waynes were killed there. So
yeah. Bob Haney decides that it's a glittering canyon of apartments and townhouses for the rich and the very rich.
Yes.
All right. So neighborhood went downhill soon after this.
Right. There you go.
The weirdest thing for me on this page is not that. The scene with Glenda Mark remarking on the various portraits of Jason Blood in his apartment. Like, he has this is in the series, it's in the original series. His apartment is full of portraits of himself back in the past, because, you know, he's been living since the time of Camelot. But he always goes like, oh no, it's just my ancestors, you know, of course we look alike. There's some fun dialogue here that's all Haney's, you know, where he flippantly says, yeah, we shared the same blood, you know. But this is a scene that is, in terms of content, is right from The Demon number one. And then from The Demon, and then she goes after those portraits again in The Demon number two. This issue comes out the same month as The Demon number 12. So come on, Glenda, are you still on this? And, you know, it just feels like you just like poached a moment from, this is the kind of stuff that makes me think sometimes it's like, okay, Bob Haney did his research, but, you know, just looked at the first couple issues.
Right. Probably so. But, you know, as somebody who's watched all 1,225 episodes of Dark Shadows, mm-hmm. I got to say, the trope of the character having a portrait of themselves hanging, and it's really them, but they try to act like, oh, no, that was my ancestor. You know, that was the deal with Barnabas Collins' vampire. You know, his portrait hung in the hall of Collinwood. And, you know, every once in a while somebody go, wow, you really do look like your ancestor who was also named Barnabas. Oh, well, that's just the family blood's just really strong. You know, family blood, of course, he's a vampire, right? So, you know, I mean, that came up quite a bit. So, I mean, I don't know if Kirby and or Bob Haney was watching Dark Shadows, but, you know, that old trope's like, well, that's just kind of part of it, you know. But in the case of Collinwood, Barnabas didn't really live there. He lived in like the old house on the property. He couldn't control whether they took the paintings down. Why is Jason hanging these portraits up and causing suspicion among people? Put them away somewhere, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's an explanation. Obviously, there's no explanation. This is cool. But maybe there's an explanation that we can ascribe to it. Like, you know, he's an immortal, and immortals still have a finite amount of memory. Like I don't remember everything that ever happened to me. Imagine if I'd lived hundreds of years. So this is kind of a reminder of other times or something. And it's a way to keep contact with the past. And I think vampires kind of have that compulsion as well. Mm-hmm. So, but in this case, yeah, it's just a thing. At least Harry and Randu know the secret.
And I guess they do in the, as far as I remember, they do in the Demon series right?
Yeah, I feel like they're well drawn. I mean, they're drawn like they are in, I mean, they're like this in the Demon. So if you read a couple issues of Demon, Kirby is very efficient. If you read a couple issues, you've got the template. You know, you can go and do your own Demon story with those characters, and they're already, you know, on the page from the beginning. They're there. Boom. That's okay. What's not, I mean, what I find very strange is the whole Merlin appearance, okay? So,
yeah.
All that Tintagel stuff, right? He lives in the ruins of King Arthur's birthplace in Britain. Tintagel. This is the first appearance of Tintagel in comics.
Okay. Okay.
It appeared later. I think Matt Wagner used it in his Demon miniseries. But
okay,
in the Kirby series, there's no Tintagel. Merlin does show up. You know, he's around. He's also narrating the series like he's Cain or Abel. But he shows up. He might give missions or punish the demon and do this, like remotely activate him or deactivate him. He can do that. But he lives on another plane of existence. You know, there's no mention of a specific place or anything. So this whole bit is invented out of whole cloth. It is also pure padding because, right? Yeah. Because there are two whole pages devoted to Merlin. One is this one where he says, hey, I'm going to need the demon tomorrow. So can we schedule, can you pencil in a meeting?
A Zoom meeting.
Right. And there's this whole page about this. And then later, you know, as I mentioned in the synopsis, during the battle, he undemons Jason Blood as a penalty for not showing up at the appointed hour. And then Randu says, don't do that. And okay, so he just like a momentary bit where the demon's not winning the fight.
Yeah.
But there's no real consequence. You know, like Jason Blood isn't hurt or anything. It's just a page of padding where, okay, the fight is on a standstill for a second, and we never do find out what Merlin's big mission was about. It doesn't connect to this story. I mean, if the team-up book in some, I don't know if Bob Haney was necessarily thinking of it this way or if the editor or, you know, if you're trying to sell other books, other characters through the team-up. You know, the Demon, it lasted 16 issues, so it's on its last legs already and, you know, in reality, at issue 12. But it was very popular in the beginning, at least. I know it was very popular. Are they trying to sell Batman readers to the demon, basically? So we'll put, like, this is what the demon is kind of like, and these are the characters in the demon, and Merlin is part of it. Maybe that's going to intrigue you enough to follow the demon now. I wonder if that's kind of part of the formula.
Yeah, it makes me, yeah, it does, it definitely does feel like this is a primer for the Demon series more than in some ways than, and we'll get to that toward the end, but then in other instances of a team up, this is more of a, you know, well, let's break into the Demon, you know, series. It's almost like for folks who are watching the Book of Boba Fett and it suddenly becomes the Mandalorian,
right?
And everybody's glad it became the Mandalorian, but still it's not, you know, it's like, but yeah, and it's interesting too, because, you know, you said that about it, like it was popular and then it was canceled at 16 issues. But, you know, like there's been a lot of talk in the last 50 years about, you know, Carmine Infantino was the publisher at the time, and he was apparently really trigger happy about canceling books. So a lot, there's been a lot said about, well, did they really need to cancel that book yet? I mean, was it really better to cancel that book and not let it continue? And just, he was always wanting to try something, you know, cancel that and try something new to see if it could be even more popular, basically what it amounts to. He wasn't one to let, you know, like if it was a mediocre seller or, a, you know, if he thought it was, he didn't even apparently wait a lot of time for the numbers to come back, because it was an archaic system they had of, like, you know, recording sales through the newsstand distribution and everything. So it makes me wonder, is like, you know, whether did he pull the plug too early on the New Gods books, the Fourth World, and did he also pull the plug too early on the Demon? I mean, but yeah, Haney's probably trying to give us you know, a taste of it here. And I like the fact that Jim Aparo draws Kirby Crackle when Merlin appears. He's got the little black dots all around him.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah, so he gives Jason his very bushy, wild eyebrows that Jack Kirby likes to draw on him. So I like the fidelity to Kirby's artwork. But again, he's still, it's still very Jim Aparo, but he's drawing Jack Kirby characters and Jack Kirby situations, and he's cognizant of how Jack Kirby handles it, and he's working that in. So good on you, Jim Aparo, for following that template that the creator gave you.
We're talking about discrepancies. The last one I want to mention is the one that drives me nuts, and it's the fact that in too many instances, 75% of the time, they don't call him the demon. They call him Demon.
Mm.
The original series called him the Demon. The title is the Demon. He's the Demon. It just bugged the hell out of me that people are calling him Demon.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're not going to call him the Demon, then call him Etrigan, or, then right. Call him by his actual name, not just Demon, like that's his name. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's not like an address. If I call out to Etrigan and I say Demon, that's fine. But that's not what's happening. It's like, Demon went over that way, or, we got to follow Demon. No, that doesn't work for me. It's not good. It's not good grammar, and it doesn't follow what Kirby set out in his own series. All right, yeah. So that was my last.
Okay.
So we get the demon. He gets his first, battle with the creature. So there are just some fun bits there as well. Or maybe we'll talk about them when we talk about cool moves, etc. And then Batman catches him with a net, catches the demon with a net. He catches the wrong creature.
Right. And oddly enough, this, we'll get into that a little bit more later, but Batman has to borrow a net from the zoo. Batman doesn't have a net. this Batman, what's the utility belt for, Batman? What do you got in there? Just snacks? Your prescription medication? I don't know. Batman, it's hard to imagine any version of Batman that doesn't have some kind of net or rope handy or something that he could have captured the demon in. It's a nice little bit that, it is a little bit of world building in some ways, because this is Park Row is an affluent part of the city. So there's probably a nice, zoo and a park nearby. And that's where he borrowed the net from. So
we're in a park. There's a carousel. This is Central Park.
Yes.
So there's a little fair element and there's a zoo in there.
Central Park Zoo. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's Park Row. So if this is like this, I think this is what Haney was imagining as Gotham. It's like, okay, it's New York.
Right.
And if you live in a townhouse giving on Central Park, yes, that is an affluent part of the city.
Right.
So, okay, so who is this creature? who the hell is this creature? We're going to need Randu to suss it out. And this is an amazing use of his ESP power, his postcognition. Like, postcognition? The way it normally works, if you believe in psychic powers, is that you touch an object that has been touched by another person, it takes you back to those moments. Like, you clairvoyantly see what the object experienced, in other words. Whatever psychic impression was left on the object or on a place.
Mm-hmm.
And usually Randu, that's what he's doing in the series, There's a lot of, although he has like a full clairvoyancy where sometimes the supporting cast knows what's happening with the demon and with Jason Blood continents away because of his clairvoyance. You're sort of, Merlin is telling us the story, but at the same time, some of the story is seen through the eyes of Randu and telling it to Harry and Glenda. So, but in this case, it's just a police sketch. And then somehow, whew, going back a century,
he accidentally ESPs onto Matt Hagen in prison as Clayface.
Yeah. So his
wrong guy.
All he needed was to see the creature, even drawn, and his power is activated. So thank God he's there.
That's strange. It's like, they could have like taken him to the morgue and shown him like one of the bodies, and maybe he touched like just the shoulder of or whatever's left of one of the victims, or I guess Harry, Harry was attacked and just like put his hands on Harry it would have probably made more sense with these ESP powers. I don't know, but he's like very Professor X here, he literally like probably, I don't even know if Professor X could do this from a police sketch. Not from a picture, no. And back into the past, too. Not just track them, but get their whole backstory from a picture,
He's just good. He's just very good at this. And so 1883, the eruption of Krakatoa.
You know, I looked it up. I thought, well, that's a real thing, right? And so yes. I looked it up, and it says the 18. This is from Wikipedia. So, you know, usually stuff like this, Wikipedia is not wrong, but I didn't look at. I should have looked it up probably from a better source. But it says the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa in the Sunda Strait occurred 20 May until 21st October 1883, peaking in the late morning hours of 27 August, when over 70% of the island of Krakatoa and its surrounding archipelago were destroyed as it collapsed in a caldera. These are words I don't use in everyday life.
Caldera is the funnel.
Right.
It's the tube. It's the volcano tube.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The eruption was one of the deadliest, most destructive volcanic events in the recorded history. The explosion was heard 3,110 kilometers away in Perth, Western Australia, and Rodrigues near Mauritius, 4,800 kilometers away. The acoustic pressure wave circled the globe more than three times. At least 36,417 deaths were attributed to the eruption and the tsunamis it created. Significant additional effects were felt worldwide in the days and weeks after the volcano's eruption. Additional seismic activity was reported until February 1884. But any reports after October 1883 were dismissed by Roger Verbeek's subsequent investigation into the eruption. But so there's a little controversy about how much. But either way, this was a massive ecological event that affected the entire world and it turned the sky into a lava monster. But
it turned the skies yellow for even through Europe. One of its legacies is apparently Munch's The Scream. We've all seen that painting, and that's supposed to be like the way the sky is and the reaction of the character. It's like, this is the end of the world type thing. And it happened. If Europe can see an effect, imagine. So, yeah.
Right.
I was fascinated by Krakatoa as a kid. There's an episode of The Time Tunnel where they go back and it's called Crack of Doom. They have to go back, obviously, and hopefully leave before the volcano explodes, right? I know that show wasn't the best place to learn history.
Well, it got you interested in it, though.
Yeah, exactly. And so I always remembered Krakatoa as this big event, you know, in the 19th century. So, and then the X-Men fight it, and they're all living on it.
That's Krakoa.
Oh, Krakoa.
I thought the same thing. I'm like, wait a minute, is that did they name the X-Men island thing and giant size X-Men? And I had to look it up like, oh, no, that's Krakoa. That's right. Yeah. And now they live on it. Right.
It is named after the volcano, I feel. You know, right. The same sounds.
It's a reference to it. Definitely. Yeah. Instead of a volcano, it's like a living, monster island. Yeah. I love the flashback, all the color. I don't know if the purples and the blues and the light greens they use and like the characters and the ship to show this is a flashback. It's really well done. It kind of reminds me of an EC comic. In some ways, and I think it's really sharp looking. I mean, if they just colored this like in the traditional, like everybody had standard, you know, Caucasian flesh colors or whatever color their flesh was, it wouldn't have been nearly as moody and atmospheric as with these muted colors of the past. I think that's really sharp.
Yeah, and Apero doesn't put in frames around the panels, so that gives it also that dreamy quality.
Yes.
Here's a recommendation from the future. To the past, instead of all those Merlin pages that we don't need, maybe add a little more here that maybe Dobbs sold his soul to something.
Right.
Why did he kill the first mate? Is he just like a psychopath or was he communing with something, you know, that needed a sacrifice or something? You know, it's like the
right
Cthulhu, you know, is in the Indian Ocean, right? And I think that's where Call of Cthulhu places it. It's like Indian Ocean stuff. Maybe it's something like that. And, you know, that would tie up more to the supernatural world of the demon, but also give us a reason why he survives this as a monster.
Yeah, I mean, if he had like even been like some kind of volcanic worshiper or something, and he like knew that this cataclysmic event was going to happen, and he was like, I'm sacrificing, you know, even if he was like, you know, some kind of zealot that's like, I killed him to sacrifice him to stop this volcano or something like that, you know, something like, I'm trying to save this ship, and then, you know, it explodes, and, you know, then he's made some kind of, you know, he's being manipulated by some other demonic thing that just wants souls or something. And then that's why he's turned into this thing. I mean, yeah, it is the comics, you know, you can, it's the DC universe or a an arm of it where you can get struck by lightning and chemicals and not die of burns or, you know, whatever, and become the Flash. So I understand you can just be covered in lava and become a lava monster, but why do you become an immortal lava monster that just, you know, lives on revenge alone?
Because he's not a metahuman because his death will be supernatural.
Right.
You know, his weakness is supernatural. So we can't say, superpowers, of course, you know. Well, now they have to stop him.
Yes.
So this is the part that's like in the fog and it's really moody and it's really cool looking. And Batman is undercover.
Yes. He's undercover. He's singing a sea shanty, and he is in one of his famous rubber masks over his cowl, which I can't get enough of Batman pulling a rubber mask off his cowl already on. I mean, it just, everybody loves that. I mean, it dates back way beyond the 70s. It was like at least back in the 50s in like the early World's Finest where he's disguised as Superman and takes his Superman mask off. But back then, Batman's ears were short too. Now he's got these long redesigned Neil Adams ears and he's pulling, you know, this mask off his head. It's just a wonderful trope. He's got his cape. He's got his whole costume under this, you know, this nautical outfit. it's a wonderful trope of old comics that, you know, Batman. I mean, of course, Batman's a master of disguise. We know that. I love it.
Yeah. I just noticed that the monster is actually in that first panel in the shadows, you know, standing on top of something. So they're like the coloring doesn't draw attention to it.
Yeah, right? I see that. I didn't notice that either. Yeah.
He's just like, you think it's just a detail in the back of the boat or whatever. But no, he's there to jump on him. And indeed, when part three begins, the derelict from the depths, the creature jumps on the seaman. The disguise makes sense until he loses his cap. The cap could have hidden the ears. But we see the back of the head. There's actually no shape in there. And then Batman takes the time to throw it all off. And then, yeah, the hypodermic needle doesn't pierce the skin, which seems like a big mistake on his part. Yeah. And then he doesn't get the backup help. And meanwhile, Jason Blood is doing all the detective work.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have switched roles. You know, like the demon can fight the creature and the Batman could maybe do the research.
Yeah, they've definitely like not playing to their strengths here. That's for certain. And Batman a few pages earlier had just basically sent, even though Randu was the one who, you know, figured out all this about Dobbs, they send Jason away and Randu and they send him away like, oh, we'll handle this. You know, this is a police matter, basically. And it's like, okay, you've already seen that this guy can turn into a demon. And I mean, Batman, as he's being choked out on that page where he's being attacked, Jason Blood, maybe you were right. I need a demon to fight a demon. Oh, well, you think? You know, like, what title are you in, Batman? This isn't your solo book. This is Brave and the Bold. I mean, come on. You team up with somebody every issue. Don't send anybody away that could possibly help you, especially if it's more their wheelhouse, right? So
he just doesn't know which comic it is.
Right. He's like, I'm so busy. I don't know what I'm in. Is this a Justice League? I mean, I don't know. What book am I in this month? This week? I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be especially true today.
Yes.
So the ship rises from the waters. Again, we're talking supernatural element, you know. This is not normal. And the creature brings Batman to the boat.
Why didn't he just kill him, though? Why did he bring Batman to the boat?
I think the creature's confused. This is my attempt at a no prize.
Okay.
The creature's confused, and because he was a sailor, and now he's not.
Mm.
Okay, I'm going to need a minute to figure this out.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring Batman over, and then I'll make a determination if he's a sailor or not.
Here, Batman, see if you can tie. How do you tie this knot? Let's see if you were in the Navy or not. Okay. Batman, Bruce Wayne was in the Boy Scouts and he kills him anyway, even though Batman was never in the Navy because he knew how to tie a knot. Right. So.
Right. He knows the sea shanties. And look, to me, the more shocking element perhaps is the demon rowing a boat, rowing himself and Randu to the ship in a small rowboat. That is such a weird image.
I mean, when I first looked at it, the way the pitch of the boat and Randy's at the back, I thought at first he had his hand on the motor of a motorboat, you know, like he controlling it. But then I looked closer and I'm like, wait a minute. Etrigan's like actually got oars in his hands. So yeah. They're rowing to the...
And we'll see the rowboat later as well, so that confirms it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm always shocked that Etrigan doesn't fly. Like, I know he doesn't fly, that's not part of his powers, but I have to relearn that information every time. Like, he can jump really far. I don't know, I've always used kid logic on him. He's got a cape, he should fly, or demons should fly. I don't know, maybe the winged ears make me think he should fly. But I'm always a little shocked that he doesn't. It's weird.
I kind of feel like he should be able to have low-level, like, teleportation, like in a, you know, puff of brimstone a la Nightcrawler. You know, that kind of makes sense, too, for a demon, right? You know, to just literally appear. Like, or if he could appear, if there was flame somewhere, he could appear through the flame. You know, something would have to be on fire, or there'd be, like, a candle or something, but he could kind of, like, appear through flame or something. That would be kind of cool, but...
Yeah. How was he supposed to get to Tintagel?
Right, exactly. Was he, like, Jason Blood going to have to, like, get a plane ticket and get to Tintagel?
And then he wouldn't have made it anyways. If you look at the power set, there's also the fact that he can cast spells. And those spells can, I can do teleport. I can do, you know, different things that aren't, like, just the firing brimstone out of his hands or mouth or jumping around or the super strength. You know, he has the ability to do a little more with some, like, demonic spell power, which probably would have been how he would get to Merlin. I don't know.
Yeah, probably so.
But yeah, he certainly doesn't here. So they're just the struggle, and Merlin interferes, as I said before, and, you know, he changes back and forth.
Yeah, and that panel of him changing back to Etrigan, that's some nice old school comic special effects. I mean, that's like the production department and Aparo. Like, you know, like there's some nice instruction there, because there's like a surprint of Jason Blood's, you know, face, like his hair. And as he like starts to turn more into Etrigan, it becomes like your standard comic with the black outline and the full color, the yellow skin and everything. It's really really sharp. And there's some nice texturing there. The
weird Zipitone that we don't usually see. Like,
it's really nicely done. It's really sharp. I mean, that was like a standout panel. I'm like, oh, that's a really cool effect. And it just made me think, you know, if Merlin wanted Jason there, why didn't he just transport him, you know, at the given time? And that could have worked as well, because he could have been fighting this monster. Merlin pulls him away, and Etrigan's like, you idiot, I was fighting a monster, and now my friend and this Batman guy are going to get killed. And then Merlin's like, whoops, sorry, got to send you back, you know, or something. But it would have worked the same way.
And then that might have been a reason to make Batman give Batman a little more agency. Mm-hmm. And, like, he wakes up, the rope is there.
Yeah.
And he puts two and two together, or Randu maybe helps him, and he's the one who throws the noose over, and it happens. And then the demon comes back and says, like, okay, yeah, you got it.
Or at least he has to save Randu before Etrigan comes back to kill the monster or whatever, you know.
Something.
But give Batman something to do, not be unconscious at the end of his own book, you know.
Right. What did you think of this resolution, the way that they stop the creature?
I don't think the ending completely works, and this is maybe just the way I read it, but Dobbs is shown with that iron collar around him before the eruption. He's got it around his neck. If they took it off of him to hang him, then, and he put it back on, you know, afterwards to protect himself, I can kind of buy that, but we didn't see that. Like you said, if we got rid of some of this Merlin stuff and some of these pages, and shown them like actually getting ready to hang him, and then the you know, it explodes, and he, you know, later puts the collar back on, that would kind of telegraph, well, why is he putting this collar back on? And then we would know, oh, he thinks that that's going to protect him against being hanged by this rope, or any rope, I guess, but particularly this rope. I get that it's the rope that they tried to hang him with, but we don't even see it.
I think that's the larger issue. Because if the volcano explodes before he walks up to the gallows, then they never take off the collar.
Right.
If the volcano hadn't exploded, they would have taken it off and he would have been hanged. Okay. So that's fine. But the fact that the gallows, or pieces of the gallows, or the noose somehow survived, like, we don't see the Lady Claire find that, bring it back. We just learn later that, you know, he comes out of the blue that, oh, yeah, the Lady Claire, you know, accidentally brought back a monster, but it also brought back these objects. No, wait, because that ship sinks.
Yeah.
So how did these elements wind up in the museum?
Yeah.
So those are, yeah, we need a little more, see somebody salvage something from somewhere and then salvage it again from a different ship. It's a little complicated. So I don't know if I believe it, because that's the element that's missing. That's exactly it. Like, where did he get the rope?
Right. I think, you know, I don't know an ending. I don't know what the ending could have been, but there wasn't, I mean, they took the time to show him taking the rope, and we had the flashback. All they had to do, we see him tugging the what's left of that boat in, and then it sinks, right? But so they could have just shown him, like, grabbing a few random things from it, including that rope, not even, like, pointed it out, but just have it to be an Easter egg so you could flip back a few pages and go, oh, there it is, you know, and that way it's kind of, you know, sneakily setting it up. But no, there's nothing. So it's kind of, the ending doesn't work, even though we see Etrigan doing the legwork, but we're not in on it enough to put two and two together. And honestly, it doesn't really add up at the end anyway. So,
yeah. And this is another instance of not showing something gruesome, right? You know, like he walks into the rope, but then it's Batman's reaction. But no, turn the page. There's a guy hanging there by the neck. That's
yes.
That's a little bit gruesome for a code-approved comic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, a lot of times they would show, like, feet hanging in a panel. Like, there's a cover where Batman's coming in a door and it looks like Robin's been hung, you know, hanged or whatever. So there's things like that. But yeah, to show the entire body hanging from the mast is, yeah, this guy's clearly, I mean, yes, he was an immortal monster that should have already been dead. But yeah, I'm kind of surprised. Obviously, at this point, the comics code is lax some, because now they're using vampires and werewolves and zombies, or even if they're zuvimbies, but, you know, but they're able to get away with a lot more than they were. But still, it is kind of shocking that they actually show it after it looks like they're not going to show it. No, they show it. So that last panel.
All right, then, who fared better? Let's do our questions for the issue.
Okay.
How well does this fit each of the stories or atmospheres? Is this a Batman story, or is it more of a demon story?
This is a demon story through and through. I think Batman is off his game in this one. He's out of his league, and he's not bright enough to ask for help against a supernatural monster from another supernatural monster and a guy with insane ESP powers. So, yeah.
All right, I agree. This is, you were almost in the subplots of Jason Blood's life, you know, Batman is hardly a concern.
Yeah. I mean, Batman could have not shown up in this. And honestly, it's like the people say about Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Batman could have not have been in this story, and it wouldn't have changed anything, really.
Okay, a question we only ask of the Brave and the Bold segment. Do they know Batman's secret identity?
No, but he knows Jason Blood's secret identity now, or Etrigan's secret identity is Jason Blood. But I think later he does. In the DC animated universe, he does, because Bruce Wayne and Tim Drake interact with Jason Blood and Etrigan in that episode of the new Batman adventure. So in one continuity, at least, that he eventually does know that Bruce Wayne's Batman.
So we don't know yet. Cool moves. What is Batman's coolest move?
I got to go with disguising himself as a seafarer in a rubber mask, and bonus points for him singing the sea shanty. That's it's kind of goofy cool. You know, it's part of the comics we grew up on, and I eat that stuff up. I love it. So.
Yeah. Well, there's not much to recommend, is there? I'm going to call out that final panel. Batman on a rowboat, his cape in the wind, the sailboat bubbling down into the harbor. I think it's a great image.
That's true.
Very moody, very Batman. Or when he jumps out of the helicopter, you know, like the poses that Batman has are always very cool. But yeah, he doesn't do very well in this particular story. What is the demon's coolest move?
I think it's figuring out that the noose was the key to defeating Dobbs, even if the story kind of cheats, not giving us enough info to figure that out too. So
it's a strong Jason Blood moment. But for Etrigan, I like the bit with the carousel. I guess it backfires on him. It doesn't really work. So I will finish that moment that you mentioned, just him swinging the noose at just the right spot. You know, that would be the coolest. He's figured it out, but here he implements the plan. And I think it looks cool as well. All right. Dumb or weird moves. Batman, which one will you choose?
Yeah, there's a multitude. Why is Batman hitching a ride with the local helicopter cop?
I mean, you said you were going to talk about this moment.
I mean, it's such a Bob Haney thing to do. And I mean, that moment alone was why I went with a more of an Adam West type Batman in this, because that's a very Adam West type thing for Batman to do. But wouldn't it have made more sense to have him in the Batcopter and put it on autopilot to drop down or something? You know, I mean, it's so bizarre to think that Batman, you know, although this is the era where, you know, Mike Friedrich and Neil Adams had Batman stopping by the police HQ to sing Christmas carols, you know, in the Silent Night of the Batman just a few years before. So Batman's on a, you know, name basis with all the cops in Gotham and just,
sure,
you know, randomly hangs out, you know, and, you know, who knows, maybe even, you know, hitches a ride with the local, you know, traffic helicopter too every once in a while and is on the radio sometimes. I don't know, but it's just...
like there's stuff happening in the harbor. Batman drives by there, gets out of the Batmobile, doesn't have time to assemble the Whirly Bat in the right trunk, you know, and it's just like the helicopter's there, the police are gonna go, so oh no, let me do it, you know. Maybe we're just missing a scene,
maybe, but it seems like he's already in it. Yeah, he's already in the helicopter with the guys, so
it is weird. For dumb moves, I think the breaking of the trank dart on the creature's skin is like, well, that was sort of underestimating the, mm-hmm, the creature, or I questioned the whole plan to trank an undead creature that survived at the bottom of the sea for almost a century.
That's true.
Yeah, like, would that even have worked, even if you could have pierced its skin? Is my question. It just seems harebrained. What about the demon? Does the demon make any mistakes?
You know, not really Etrigan or Jason's weird move for me, but Merlin just showing up to remind people he's Etrigan's boss. And he can even tell him whether or not he can date, because he's like, no, you don't have time for Glinda. I didn't make you Etrigan. I didn't bond you to Etrigan to have you like date a mortal woman. So knock it off. And then later he takes his powers away because he missed their Zoom meeting, you know. So, I mean, just
hey, what the heck? But you mentioned Etrigan's actual weird move earlier. I think rowing himself and Randu to the ship is weird. You know, I like it, but it's just a strange image for a superhero comic.
You know, he's not rhyming yet, but we know later that Etrigan is a rhyming demon. Does he sing, row, 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 row your boat?
Do you know row, row, your boat?
Your boat? Do you know row your boat? It's a song. You sing it, you yellow-eared demon, you know, or something. I don't know.
All right. Friendly farewell. This team-up tradition, how does this farewell rate?
I think they definitely part on friendly terms, even though we don't see it. Batman is in on Jason's secret, something Glinda doesn't even know. So now Batman's in the circle of Randu and Harry, who know who Jason is. I don't know if other comics ever acknowledge this again. I'm sure they do at some point. But yeah, so Batman is now an ally. And, you know, and Jason Blood is possibly an ally if Batman needs some help with some kind of supernatural problem, which I wish they'd done more of, honestly. I think this could have, mm-hmm, especially since they're both in Gotham. So
Yeah. I'm surprised there isn't more to this relationship. But I think it's confirmed, the friendliness is confirmed by what Bob Haney writes in the final caption.
Mm-hmm.
Farewell, Jason Blood, alias the demon. So he's himself doing the farewell. Perhaps you'll again return to the pages of Brave and the Bold at some unknown time of need. So is this a way of telling us that he really liked to write the character, or that he has other ideas that he wants to implement later? And he will, of course. The demon shows up again in this series at some point. The writer says, yeah, they're friends now.
Yeah.
We'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
and the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics. After the great disaster of 2099, the gates of hell stood open and Earth was overrun. By the 31st century, humanity had colonized the rest of the solar system, and no one dares go back to the mother world. No one except the Demons of the Galaxy, that is. Led by demonologist Vance Astroblood, this rebel group will take the planet back from the demonic Badoom. Ironically, thanks to the demon blood in their own veins. In the next issue of Demons, Entrajex, the pillowy Harry 27, and the flame-haired Nikki Marks are joined by a new member, Yondon the Witch Archer. But can he be trusted? Find out in Demons of the Galaxy number 18, Sharper Than a Demon's Tooth, only from Amalgam Comics.
We're back. Our monthly feature, the bonus team up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect demon team up. What do you got?
I would like to see Etrigan the Demon team up with DC's resident Ghostbreaker, Dr. 13. They probably have in recent years, but in old school pre-crisis continuity, I don't believe they ever did. Dr. 13 was a character that was from the 40s in Star Spangled Comics and had a feature, but then later he was a foil in the Phantom Strangers comic in the 70s, drawn by Jim Aparo. The guy is totally in denial about actual supernatural phenomenon existing around him, despite knowing the Phantom Stranger. This guy is completely clueless. Imagine how he'd deal with Jason Blood transforming into Etrigan right in front of him. He'd probably say it was special effects or something. I mean, it would just be hilarious to see this guy interacting with Jason Blood and just thrown straight into this world of where this guy just, you know, chance turns into a demon, shoots fire out of his hands. You know, I mean, I would love to see how this guy's mind is blown and then how he rationalizes everything away, because he's like the worst character in a lot of ways. It's just like, I mean, I get on Batman for like being, you know, like dubious about supernatural elements. It's like, you've teamed up with the Spectre. I mean, come on, you know. But also, if it wasn't Dr. 13, maybe Ed the Helicopter Cop, maybe him. That'd be good too.
For me, I'll go back to his origins and team the demon up with Prince Valiant.
Ooh.
I would love to see a story with the, like the Hal Foster look, like the Garth Ennis demon, or something, you know, who takes umbrage because the prince uses his face for a mask. So shenanigans ensue in King Arthur's court. You know, it's a part homage, part satire parody. You know,
yeah,
that's what I had this time around.
Nice. You could throw in Sir Justin the Shining Knight in there too if you wanted to. Just
yeah,
to, in
I
the background.
Would use the whole cast of Camelot. You know, and take him down a peg.
Yeah. So who's brave and bold next? This might be an indexing show, but it's going to jump around as inspired by the issue we're looking at now. So every episode will explain the thematic logic between this episode's guest star and the next. So Siskoid, where to now and how do we get us there?
Okay, well, the demon is a red and yellow hero created by one of early Marvel's seminal artists. You hear his laughter in the night and you despair. And that sounds a lot like the Creeper. So I had several choices if I wanted the Creep. In particular, Brave and the Bold number 143, which also features Gotham Harbor. That was like my first choice. But I remember us promising that jumping around would vary the creative teams. And it really hasn't to date. You know, we have different writers, but it's always been Jim Aparo. So right. I went back further to finally get us a Neil Adams issue. So next time we record, Chris, we'll talk about Brave and the Bold, number 80, which also features the first appearance of the Hellgrammite.
Oh, nice. Yes. Yes, that's a good one. All right.
Okay, now it's time for the feedback on our previous episode that we did together, in which we covered Brave and the Bold, number 120, starring Batman and Commandy. Why don't you start us off?
All right, Jeff R. writes in to say, I want to read Blaze, the Last Boy in Hell, more than any previous amalgam from this series.
Thank you, Gene Hendricks, for doing the voice on that. I think that's half the power of the promo. Captain Entropy says, I'm partway through and loving this, but a quick point before I forget. I think Last Boy on Earth was hyperbole, like Last Son of Krypton. Yes, Captain Entropy, obviously, humanity kept going after this point, so he can't have been the last of his generation unless space humans return at some point. I don't know. But I like the thematic idea of Anthro as the first, Homo sapiens boy, and Commandy as the last. And like, I don't want anything like the ridiculous Garth in this story to get in the way of that, you know? Within the Commandy stories, he should be the only teenage boy. And so Captain Entropy says, so, how about last boy with enough sense to survive to manhood, and it just won't fit on the cover. So I'm sorry. And then Captain Entropy comes back. He's fully listened to the show at this point and says, I especially appreciate Siskoid's geographical research, Chris's Kirby-Haney comparison, and the Commandy knowledge. Chris, Batman is usually so laconic and stoic that your insertion of Apes movie quotes into his dialogue was jarring. More so because you really sound like Batman. You helped me realize that Heston was a total drama queen. I know everyone else knew.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of ham in Charlton Heston, that's for sure.
As far as Batman's killing blow, I think the comparison to the arcane Dimmak of Legend is unwarranted. I think the death touch was supposed to block the target's energies and drain him of his chi. What we saw in the panel was less sophisticated, a full apparel force bat blow to the base of the skull. Lots of people can do that, not as well as Batman, of course, but still. Reminds me of what one comedian said about killing vampires. Stake through the heart? Won't that kill just about anything?
Yeah. But, you know, the thing with vampires and the stake through the heart is, That's like from, you know, European superstition, and when people would actually like were worried about their dead relatives rising from the grave as a vampire, they would literally stake them into the ground.
Right. It's a preventive measure.
Yeah, it's a preventive measure. So the staking through the heart just kind of evolved into that's what you do to a vampire. But it really comes from history where they would stake the bodies down. It would mutilate their family members' bodies. It's really awful. So, oh God. Yeah. Moving on. Rob McCarthy wrote, DC superheroes always know when that blow would have killed a normal man, just like Marvel heroes always know. That blow would have taken my head off if I hadn't rolled with the punch. Yeah, I think Spider-Man said that in the first Superman-Spider-Man Treasury comic, right? Yeah.
It's a way to explain why they don't die from a super strong character hitting them, right?
Right, yes.
Brian Linton says, you're not alone, Siskoid. My wife and daughter will sometimes hop on Google Maps to check locations and follow the action when they're reading books set in the real world.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you guys go figure out Krakatoa now. There you go. That's your homework. Go.
Yeah. Where was it? Where is
Where
it?
Where was it exactly? Some guy named Rob Kelly writes in, between the subject matter, Siskoid's narration, and Chris's role-playing, this episode felt like the audio from a lost episode of Video Comics. Great fun. We know you love your video comics, Rob. Batman keeps his mask and costume on throughout the adventure, even though everyone who might know remember Bruce Wayne are long dead. Way to commit, Bruce.
Look, you never know when, oh, this is just like Hugo Strange screwing with me.
Right, that's true, yeah. Batman, yep. The Mad Hatter's got him hooked up to some machine that's right, making him think he's somewhere
Don't
else.
Don't take off the mask.
Right. Co-signed to Chris, horses are impossible to draw. Apparel could draw anything well. Yeah, just like we saw in this issue, he's great at drawing, you know, 1800s nautical ships and, you know, costuming and everything.
The bridge building, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Martin Gray says, the mentions of Mount Rushmore brought back an embarrassing memory. When I was a kid, I thought it was a natural phenomenon, that somehow the people who became president were chosen by the mountain, which actually sounds a tad Kirby-esque. We're not laughing at you, Martin. We're laughing at the situation.
We're laughing at, yeah. I think you're right. That does sound like something Kirby would come up with exactly. That's what I'm laughing at. I mean, that sounds like some, these people have risen from the ground. You are now our leader. You know, it's just, you know.
It's like a source wall, you know, it's just faces.
Exactly. Yeah. Paul Keen, who is one of the co-hosts of Batman Family Reunion, so he knows a thing or two about Batman, writes in, great episode as usual, guys. Love that you talked about the old Professor Nichols stories when I was a kid. I love them, especially the one with the man in the iron mask. Ooh, that is a good one. All drawn by Dick Sprang. Great. I don't know where this hypnosis as time travel started either, but we are even seeing it today, albeit in a technological way, in The Peripheral on Amazon, taken from the William Gibson book, of course, which now I must also read. I, too, am intrigued by the Commandy equals Tommy Tomorrow idea. I never quite was able to reconcile it in my head, but who knows? Maybe after some crisis or another, we will get that team up. Well, the way DC's continuity is nowadays, man, I have no idea. So, yeah, we might.
we can without any crisis to happen. You know, it's like a lot of the books are just like, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Bucky749 says, was there ever a team up with Batman and a character called Alice of a Thousand Gimmicks? I think presumably you mean Mary, Girl of a Thousand Gimmicks, was the part of the cast of Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy.
Mm-hmm.
No, because she was strictly Golden Age. I don't think she appears in Brave and the Bold. Though it was Bob Haney could say, Wildcat doesn't need to be on Earth 2. I guess Mary wasn't on his radar. She's a minor Golden Age character.
She was brought up occasionally on the Stargirl TV series, oddly enough, though, yeah.
Probably why he's, you know, it's on his radar.
Yeah.
But at the time, Mary was, she's in Who's Who, and I didn't know she existed.
That's right. The Irredeemable Shag writes in to say, great episode, but Chris legitimately forgot the name of Princess Ariel from Thundar? What? How is that possible? I'd say she was formative in my youth, but that implies that situation is past tense. Yeah, I guess Ariel, you know, it's there's Princess Aura, there's Princess Ariel, there's another Princess Ariel, obviously, that's the Little Mermaid.
Yep.
There's just too many, there's Adora, there's, you know, I mean, there's just too many different princesses with an A name that just got stuck in my brain. I'm sorry, got clogged.
Well, when's the last time you watched Thundar?
It's been a while, yeah. You know, even though that's got the Alex Toth and Jack Kirby, you know, designs, the series looks very, very Jack Kirby. You know, it's great. Yeah.
It was a favorite when I was a kid, but I haven't seen it since.
I can hear the theme song in my head right now, though.
Oh, wow.
So that, yeah.
Yeah, you're more into it. All right. Well, thanks for teaming up with me, Chris. How about you tell people what else you're working on at the moment? What can we expect from your corner of the network?
Cindy and I are working on JLUcast. We're into season 2 of the actual Justice League Unlimited. And actually, as we record this, I am working on the notes for an episode that features another Jack Kirby creation who's also red and yellow with a little bit of green. That's Mr. Miracle. So, yeah.
I could have gone there. Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the worst thing is, I've been reading some Mr. Miracle this morning for another project.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But no, we're going with the Creeper. Well, we've just done 2 Kirby characters, right? We need to move on. All right. A reminder that we do have a Patreon. So if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a one-time or a monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW podcast. And this month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts, and the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also visit the Fire and Water Podcast Network Facebook page, find us on Twitter, where we're FW Podcasts. We'll read your comments on this issue when Chris is back with us, but next month, I'll be here with our friend Ryan Daly as we continue his coverage of Marvel 2-in-1 with issue 5 of that title, so you can read up in advance. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.